We're going to be discussing the idea of the false binary.
What an illusion of choice does, it establishes the baseline assumptions that nobody questions.
This is part of the fifth generation warfare that we've talked about. Voting for the lesser of two evils is definitely an emotional, psychological trap that people are in.
You're cheerleading for an insane ideology because you think you're winning.
The role we have is media. How do we help everybody understand this is theater and you need to get back into the real world?
If you're opposed to the agenda, you should oppose it regardless of who's selling it to you.
Hello, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com, with another edition of the Solutions Watch / Independent Media Alliance panel. Thank you for joining us today, and a special thank you to all of those who are watching live. And hopefully you are here because you already know that we are going to be talking today about books that inspire. Specifically, each member of the panel has been requested to come today to bring a recommendation for a book that meant something to them, that inspired them, that changed their lives, that set them on their path, etc. So we're going to hear from all of the usual suspects in the Independent Media Alliance. And rather than introducing everyone up front, we'll introduce them as they come on, with the special exception of today's special guest, not a member of the Independent Media Alliance, but a special guest for today. Hopefully my listeners know him. He is Tim Lacey. He is the publisher of Reportage, Essays on the New World Order, amongst other books. But let's concentrate on Reportage for the moment. Tim Lacey, thank you for joining us today. And I am looking forward to hearing about your book recommendation.
Well,
before we do that, just again, tell people, for the benefit of those who do not know about you, who you are, where you come from, what's your name, rank, and serial number.
Name, rank, and serial number. That's right. My name is Tim Lacey. I am the owner of the company that publishes James Corbett's books in English. I guess that's a good way to describe things until further notice, until you start two-timing on me. But James is published in Japanese, German, what else? Romanian,
yes. Yeah. That is the other one.
Yeah, we got to get these books and flash them around on camera. I live in the United States. I'm in New Mexico right now. Started out when James and I first connected. I was in Hollywood, and I've been back and forth to Japan a couple of times. I'm a graphic designer by trade. My profession, my education was fine art, but I've always been interested in books and book design. And graphic design in general, I've made a life of it, but I've also made a hash of it. I do a lot of different things.
Awesome. We're going to leave it there for
now. Yeah, good, good.
We'll have more to say after your recommendation, etc. And in fact,
need to glut.
Exactly. In fact, I am going to take the prerogative here of going first and setting the tone for this conversation. So I'm going to go first with my recommendation. And I hope everyone who is listening live, all of the Corbett Report members who are tuned in, are ready with your own recommendations to drop in the chat, because we'll be talking about them after the panel has come along and done their recommendations. But let's get straight into it with recommendation number one. James Corbett's book that inspires, that he recommends for people out there. And it will come as no surprise what book I am choosing if you happen to have read Reportage, Essays on the New World Order, because you will know in that book I talk about Animal Farm and its special significance in my life. So obviously, I would hope that people in my audience know Animal Farm by George Orwell. Of course, you know 1984, because I reference it probably, you know, half of the episodes I do, because it's highly relevant. But Animal Farm, of course, being his other very famous, very popular novel, the one that actually brought him a degree of fame and notoriety, his second last novel before he penned 1984, shortly before dying. It is, of course, a fairy story. It's a fable. It's about a farm and the animals that take over this manor farm that's run by this evil Farmer Jones. And they overtake the farm. They rebrand it Animal Farm, and they institute the Seven Commandments of Animalism and start running this farm as a brave collective. And of course, as we all know, hopefully, spoilers for anyone who hasn't read it yet, but yes, obviously that revolution does not quite go as the animals had originally intended, and it ultimately devolves into tyranny. And as I say, you'll probably know a little bit about my experience with this if you've read Reportage, specifically my essay on why I write, where I talk about my inspiration and how I got into writing at all in the first place. And I, in that essay, I share, when I was 13, my class read George Orwell's Animal Farm, after which our language arts teacher asked us to write a sequel to the story. The best idea in my version of Animal Farm 2, and the only one I remember, was to portray the space race as a literal foot race between two of the farmyard animals, one representing the Soviets and the other the Americans. Truth be told, the idea wasn't even mine. The teacher had suggested it to me. Nonetheless, she was evidently impressed enough with my literary prowess to share the story with her colleagues in the break room. The very next week, our social studies teacher made the rest of the class read my story and answer a quiz about it. I recall sitting there with my head down on my desk, doing my level best not to die of embarrassment. I especially remember the moment my crush rolled her eyes at her friend over the sheer tediousness of the exercise. Needless to say, we never dated. Yeah, obviously this was formative for me. I would say in two specific ways. Animal Farm was not only formative of my literary tastes and experience, it was probably one of the first books of literature that I read, and set me along the path towards eventually becoming an English major and devoting my life to reading and writing in various forms. But also, of course, it was, I would say, very formative for my political consciousness. The idea of the glorious revolution. Of course, we have these wonderful ideas and ideals, and boy, we're going to band together, but it inevitably seems to devolve into the exact same thing, so that the animals look from the pigs to the men and they can no longer tell which is which. I think that was a very formative idea in my early years that gave me a sense of the type of corruption that inevitably sets in to these types of conversations and political machinations. So I will just say, for anyone who hasn't read Animal Farm yet, it's an extremely easy read. You can read it in a couple of hours if you put your mind to it, or whatever, take a few weeks. But at any rate, it's not difficult to read, but it is, I'd say, an important book and by a great writer. So I am going to recommend Animal Farm. But enough about me. Let's bring on the rest of the crew. And as I say, let's start with Tim Lacey. Tim, your book.
Oh, my book. I happen to have it right here. This is the Picador edition of Umberto Eco's Travels in Hyperreality. It is, I think it was first published in 1986. It's a collection of, you guessed it, essays and articles. It's not heavy-duty academic stuff. Let me just show you the first page. How do you like them apples? It's a collection of essays. Let me just look at the table of contents so I can refresh my memory. I got this soon after it came out. Travels in Hyperreality. Hyperreality is one word, two R's. And he talks about essentially Disneyland, or the Disneyfication of things, not in the sense of commercial property or commercial branding, but in the unreality of things, the next level of reality. And then there's wonderful sections in here. I just suggest everybody pick it up. The reason I brought it to James's attention sometime last year was a specific essay called Cogito Interruptus in a section called De Consolatione Philosophiae, on the consolation of philosophy. Umberto Eco was a by trade, I guess you'd say he was a semiotician, which meant something in the 1980s. He was a medieval scholar. He was a scholar, but most of these essays were written for periodicals, for newspapers and things. So they are definitely for general reading, and they're commentaries on meaning and on, semiotics means signs and symbols and communication, essentially. The Cogito Interruptus essay that I mentioned to James is he's basically taking Marshall McLuhan to task along the lines of, show your work. regarding understanding media. So James and I have had that discussion. I'll find that one quote that inspires me so much. I didn't think of looking it up, but I know I have it marked. There it is. He's talking about mass media, and he says, just one carp. The redundance is real, not apparent, picking up on an earlier point. But this is the kicker right here. As with the best products of mass entertainment, the confusion of collateral information serves only to make appetizing a central structure that is unrelentingly redundant, so that the reader will receive always and only what he has already known or understood. Unrelentingly redundant captured my imagination. It's beautiful prose, in fact. But he's talking about media and a central structure that is unrelentingly redundant. That hasn't changed in 40 years of consuming media and the expansion of media into every aspect of our lives. I think it's relevant for all the people in this panel too, as well. Just apply that to anything. I'll write it up and you can post it with the show notes, just that one particular quote. But I've always come back to that. That said, the other essays in the book are really wonderful too. He talks about the Jim Jones. There's an article in there about the Jonestown massacre, mass suicide. He doesn't get into the truth of the matter. He gets into the essentials, really first principles concerning cult thinking, groupthink, and cult thinking, which is also extremely fascinating. In other words, he's not operating from like a CIA debriefing or anything like that. He's Umberto Eco, after all. Let's look at the table of contents again. And
well, you say that else. he's not into CIA debriefings or stuff. But I mean, come on, have you read Foucault's Pendulum? Because this guy knew something about conspiracies.
Well, that's another reason. I was very happy to bring this book up. There is a later edition to this that looks really, you know, like New Yorker-ish, kind of New Yorker magazine, but it's just a fascinating group. There's a section on the Middle Ages, which I think is also fascinating. The intellectual history of our culture is really my jam. You know, I'm very interested in understanding like why we think the way we think, why we're so different from other cultures. And you look at it now, civilizationally, there's Russia, there's China, there's Iran. These aren't just, you know, centers of aggravation for the Western establishment. They are different mindsets, different intellectual cultures, different intellectual histories. And as we pull our heads out of a collective, let me be polite, blind alley that has lasted for say 300 to 500 years in the West. I think this Umberto Eco's examination of these things in this particular book are very interesting. And that does factor into Foucault's Pendulum as well. I got a copy of Foucault. I met him at a book signing at B. Dalton or something in New York City when Foucault's Pendulum came out. And I sent that novel to my parents. And my dad said later, it was around Thanksgiving, I guess. I sent it as a Christmas present, signed, you know. And my dad said, well, you never gave me very many books, so I figured I'd better read it. And he said, it reminds me a little bit of the Satanic Verses. This sort of dates it as well. It's early 90s, late 80s, probably 89, 90.
Late 80s, yeah.
Yeah. And he said, so much of that book, Foucault's Pendulum, he meant, made me think of the ravings of a deranged mind, you know. So, well, it's not wrong, you know.
No, in fact, that's kind of part of the point of the book. Anyway, for people who don't know, that is the subject of my next film literature, New World Order. So, I'll be talking about that very shortly. And for people who are interested, who are Corbett Report members, you still have time to sign up to join that live stream as that conversation takes place. Tim Lacey, Show the book once again, Travels in Hyperreality by Umberto Eco. It's a collection of essays. I have that exact edition sitting on my book stand upstairs where I have been reading through it myself. And as you say, yes, Oedipo Interruptus. I am somewhat jealous of the fact that you do have the personally signed copy there, because I did not have the chance to meet Mr. Eco. But I think we will move along to our next panel member. We'll bring you back at the end for the discussion. Thank you, Tim. Let's move on to Jason Burmis. And again, I'm sure the regulars of the Independent Media Alliance will know about Jason Burmis. But for the benefit of those who don't, Jason, how can people find your work? And then what's your book?
Yeah, I'm on YouTube for some reason these days. I think you're actually streaming this to YouTube. It's a new day. But I've had that channel, since 2007. Documentary filmmaker. All my films are free there. Loose Change, Final Cut, Fabled Enemies on 9/11, Larger Picture Films, Invisible Empire, A New World Order Defined, and Shade the Motion Picture. And Invisible Empire actually has a section that, you know, some of the information aligns with my choice, my book. And that is The Franklin Scandal by Nick Bryant. I'm going to brag here as well. Also personalized and signed. Thank you so much, Nick. And I actually had Nick on my program maybe 2 weeks ago, so I'm very lucky to kind of have this, rapport with a guy's work who I really, really admire. So for those that don't know about the Franklin Scandal, a story of power brokers, child abuse, and betrayal, long before the zeitgeist was aware of Epstein, and I believe that this was published in 2010. So really, you only had the Miami court case, and it still wasn't really in the mainstream. I was aware of that story. I'd been reporting on it, but certainly hadn't got to the depths of that story. Well, Nick Bryant is also the guy that got the original black book of Epstein published, as well as the flight logs. And why this book is so important, just like James is telling you about Reportage and Animal Farm being a big part of that. By the way, they just did like a Disney-esque animated Animal Farm. That's something we will discuss at the end. There was a book I'd read called The Franklin Cover-Up by John W. DeCamp. Okay. And in many ways, that shocked and changed me because it got rid of my normalcy bias as to the depths and depravities of what some people would call the elite are actually into. I call them the predator class, and especially after reading something like that. However, there were so many things in it that I really had to take with a grain of salt. And there's one story in particular that haunts me to this day, and it's recreated in this book. And what's really important about this book is, number one, Nick Bryant went in there to try to disprove. He wasn't even going to really be writing a book. He was just going to write a piece. The documentation in this book at the end, all of this from the handwritten police notes to the actual police and FBI documents is incredible. And that's what I really want. I want the source material on top of that piece of work, especially when we're talking about nonfiction. And this book does it in spades. I've lent it out numerous times to individuals that just aren't aware of this stuff. And everybody, a pretty large book, they read it cover to cover. They actually check out the documentation. They always come back with, you know, I just didn't know. And for me, I think that's, you know, that's a very important thing. So I can't recommend it enough. I think that, you know, if you're going to choose one of the two books, this one is obviously it. You can go back and read the other one. But Nick Bryant kind of goes through all that information and then finds even more. So, James, this is my pick right here.
Awesome. Sorry, when did you say you read that first?
I would say I read it. I got the book almost when it just came out, right? So it had to be 2010, I think it was released. Yeah. Might have been 2009. But I'd already read, and I have a copy of the other one. I want to say that one was kind of in the zeitgeist when I was investigating 9/11. So I even read that pre-working for InfoWars on like a PDF file. Got a hard copy while I was there. But once again, I mean, I know you're aware of the material. And I wish that Derek Brose was with us, because he's really been discussing some of the modern day stuff with this today, right? And that's the thing. It's still so unbelievable to people, or they go the other direction where everything is this. And I think that, you know, guys like Bryant have continued to put out the real documented evidence and not gone one way or the other. And that's what you need. You need discernment, especially when working with something like this.
That's it. Awesome. Good, solid recommendation. Thank you for that, Jason. All right, let's keep the party rolling and let's bring on Ryan Christian of The Last American Vagabond. Once again, Ryan, tell people for the benefit of those who are just tuning in who you are, where you come from, and what your recommended book is.
Ryan Christian, lastamericanvagabond.com. It's one that, you know, there's so many we could have chosen, right? There's so many different obvious ones that I'm sure are impactful. I'm going to go with something that, you know, honestly, this was the first thing that jumped into my mind when I was thinking about this, and it's going to be very clear why. When I was first, like long before The Last American Vagabond was ever created, I, you know, and this is one of the reasons why that was something that was in my mind. I've traveled a lot. You know, it was something I did very early, right out of high school. My buddy and I went and traveled to Hawaii and ever since then I've been traveling a lot, went to Italy and different places. And ultimately it was just about trying to, like, you know, discover and break out. And one of the things that caused that really kind of opened my mind to that is a book called Vagabonding from Ralph Potts. Now it's really a kind of like a how-to guide. And more than that, it's more so about a trick guide, like going through those different categories on different parts. And, you know, basically, long story short, it's about like how to travel in a long-term way with no destination in the cheapest way possible, about the travel itself, not just, you know, in the way most in the West tend to travel, where you go and seek out all the comforts of home. It's about trying to immerse yourself in the actual culture in the world and find it in a way to where you can just continue to travel. Also finding ways to sort of like make money on the way. And the whole point is about sort of never ending travel with no destination. Not everybody, you know, most can't do that. But when I read this, I was already of that kind of mindset. And it really just kind of opened my mind to, you know, at that point, even I was sort of like, oh, well, you can't really travel unless you've got lots of money. That's pretty much what most people think, because we see it a very specific way. And after I read this, it just, I got so excited about it and ultimately drove me to go take a lot of, you know, like, for example, when I went to Spain, which is actually where I got this picture, did the El Camino de Santiago. It was this very idea that kind of spurred this on, because it was a crazy, I just randomly decided to go. There wasn't much planning. I got the ticket on super cheap. I found something, like, not to go into in depth on it, but went through all the tricks in this and ended up getting like a special ticket price and bottom line ended up just kind of going. And I didn't have much planned. And that was the whole exciting part of it. And most people kind of find that, you know, even myself, I was very nervous. But the point was about trying to broaden your horizons. And so going through this, people that want to, you know, buy it and take a look at it, it'll really kind of excite you about the different ways you can travel. And especially, well, I will actually say today, which is interesting and sort of depressing at the same time, is I think we all know we're in a very different place in the world today. And even myself, I've changed the frequency and the style of which I travel. And so it's sad to think that when I was doing this, when I first was inspired by this and then all the travel since, like, for example, in Europe, when I was doing this, you didn't need a passport to go between countries. You could literally just hop on a train, walk across the border. You know, there was some level of awareness, but there was no, like, I was actually, funny enough, on a quick side story, when I first traveled for the very first time, I was all excited about getting different stamps on my passport. Ended up going into, I think it was Italy for the first, or it was Greece for the first time, and then ultimately going to Italy after that and being all disappointed that I didn't get a second stamp. Kind of a meaningless thing, but realizing, oh, that's so weird. You don't need it to go through. And so the point is today, you have all the security checks and surveillance and all that stuff. So it's kind of sad at the same time. But that's the general gist of it. It really did just kind of open me to a different type of travel. And then the bigger part of that is, because I went through this, it just opened my worldview. You know, and really to expand the way that I see things. And I can't even begin to explain how impactful it was. That first trip of meeting different people all across the world, you know, different people traveling across me and realizing how wildly sheltered we are. And I think that's the same for anybody that grows up in one place and doesn't listen or hear or get introduced to other opinions. And it was like, oh, so that thing that we all absolutely know, everyone else has a different opinion about or has a different understanding of entirely. And so it just kind of opened my mind to it. But I recommend it. I really hope people will find ways to travel even with all of this, because it's profound.
Who knew that The Last American Vagabond actually comes from
something. You're actually adding inspiration. I never knew the story behind that. So there you go.
I've always told the story of just like the inspiring, you know, like the idea and what it means, but like the word itself, you know, to a degree, there's other influences, but definitely from that book to one degree. Yeah.
And when did you first read that book again?
God, to date it would be difficult. I'm going to say probably 2021, maybe like a little bit like the post high school before really getting into things time frame. My buddy actually is the one who introduced it to me. And actually, funny enough, was one of the people that was traveling with me in the beginning and kind of started his own thing, but didn't ended up petering out. And so, you know, it's funny. We both talk about that today as this has become something neither of us expected, you know?
Awesome. Well, this is the first recommendation that I haven't read yet. So I will put it on my to-read list. Thank you very much for that, Ryan. All right. Okay, let's keep the party going. We're going to talk to Steve Poikkanen of AM Wake Up. Steve, thank you for joining us. How can people find you, and what book do you want them to know about?
Yeah, so at the moment, and thank you as always for hosting these panels and having the IMA along with it. I'm Steve. You can find my work on Rumble and Substack and just about everywhere but YouTube, as I'm currently still unable to upload anything there without it immediately receiving a strike. But that's all under AM Wake Up, which you can also watch Monday through Friday from 7 to 10 Pacific Standard Time in the morning. And I'm sure, like Ryan and a handful of other people, with James was like, hey, it's book report day at the IMA. We all got out like 15 and we're like, okay, which 8 to 10 am I going to choose from? And there's various points in my life where various books mean more than now, and so on and so forth. What I settled on was a very lengthy essay, and I wish I had a copy of it, but I don't. I had my truck got set on fire a couple of years ago, and one of the things that went up with it was the majority of my book collection, so I don't have anything for show and tell today, but you can find it very easily. It's called The Power of the Powerless by Vaclav Havel. And Vaclav Havel went on to become the first president of a non-Soviet socialist Czechoslovakia. And this is where I was first introduced in concrete terms to the idea of parallel systems and parallel structures in a way that has never left my life. And I read this book for the first time, I want to say in the mid to late 90s. I got it at the most unlikely of places. It was handed to me at a rainbow gathering where I was at under duress and against my will. Did not want to be there, was not having a good time. Wound up in like a 2 a.m. conversation with a couple of random people and walked away from that conversation with this book. It's a dissection of authoritarianism and authoritarian regimes and how authoritarian regimes proliferate despite the fact that in reality there are relatively few authoritarians per mass amount of citizens. So it was an examination of how do these power structures get to prevail when everyone clearly hates them and everyone is clearly opposed to them. And it was one of the most fascinating deep dives into deconstructing authority that to this day that I've ever read. I want to throw a couple of quotes out, if I may, just from the book, and perhaps we'll you know, glean a little information as to why this appealed to me. But if the one is, if the main pillar of the system, and this doesn't have to be specifically a communist regime, this can be any authoritarian, totalitarian, tyrannical structure. We're certainly watching the formation of that technocratic grid ed structure being built and implemented currently. If the main pillar of the system is living a lie, then it's not surprising that the fundamental threat to it is living in truth. This is why it must be suppressed more severely than anything else. And this is, I think, I hope, I pray, I believe, a fundamental tenet of what the Independent Media Alliance operates on. Living in that truth in a opposition, direct opposition, direct dissent, out loud, proud, open dissent of these authoritarian structures. The second thing that I want to highlight from it is this quote, as the interpretation of reality by the power structure, ideology is always subordinated ultimately to the interests of the structure. And we see this every day with shifting narratives from, regime figures, whether it's Trump or Milikowski or, Zelensky, Xi Jinping, anything. The narrative constantly shifts because you're expected to shift with the narrative. Perhaps some overlaps to 1984 in there. And ultimately, when I read this book, it was a couple of years before I got truly involved with boots on the ground activism. But I would say this is what led me to participate in things like the WTO protests or Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Oakland, when it happened, and has really helped hone my perspective on things like parallel structures, like parallel systems, and how you can go about achieving those, living in truth, speaking truth in the face of authoritarianism.
Steve, were you aware that just very recently on Film Literature in the New World Order, we read Powerless by Harry Turtledove? Have you heard of this book? So this is it's an alternate history book or an alternate sci-fi future or present book in which the Soviets took over the world. And so it's about Soviet California and people living under that. But it is directly inspired by Power of the Powerless by Vaclav Havel. So we discussed that particular essay in that Film Literature New World Order as well. So hopefully Corbett Report members will already be read up on that and will know how powerful of an essay that is. It's truly, I was quite blown away. I only read it for the first time after reading Powerless. So I was quite blown away by it. And I can see why it was inspiring. About how long ago did you first read that?
Yeah, so I'm gonna guess just shy of 30 years ago.
Right.
It was, mid to late, probably 97, maybe 98.
It's the type of thing I wish I had read 30 years ago because it would have been very inspiring. So hopefully there are some young people in the crowd who haven't read it yet, or even some older people who need to read that.
I think it's one of those things. It's like a cerebral energy drink. It doesn't matter when you pick it up and when you put it in you, it's going to have that immediate kinetic effect. Yeah.
And as you say, I mean, it's obviously written in the context of the Soviet Union and all of that, but it's about tyranny, generally speaking, and it's quite philosophical. So I think people will be able to get something out of it for our own day and time, don't you think?
Certainly, certainly.
Yeah. Awesome. All right, Steve, very good choice. Thank you for that. All right. Next up, we've got Charlie Robinson of Macro Aggressions. And again, I hope people in my audience will already be familiar with Charlie. At the very least, he's interviewed me on his podcast. I believe we're going to be having a conversation again very soon. So look forward to that. But Charlie, tell people how they can find your work and what book you'd like them to read.
Hopefully they're getting some news over at activistpost.com. It's a fantastic resource, one-stop shop for articles written by fearless journalists writing about events that matter in the time when they matter, not 3 years after the fact. You can also catch me, macroaggressions.io is my website. You can catch the podcast wherever podcasts are served. My book that I chose, Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. This was a combination of the content of the book and the timing at which it hit me. I read this book in March of 2007. I was walking out the door to go on vacation. A buddy gave it to me and said, "You should read this. I think you'll like it." It changed my life in a variety of ways. It opened me up to the scale of the scam. Now, I knew banks were crooked, and in 2007, I was living in Las Vegas working in real estate. So I'm in the middle of the biggest real estate bubble you can imagine, and of course, we know how that ends. And we were, on a smaller scale, loaning money to people who really shouldn't be borrowing it, and they were buying houses that they couldn't afford. And I read John Perkins' book, and I see how that debt enslavement scam was being run at the highest levels by the World Bank and IMF to get governments, entire countries in debt bondage to them, and then extracting concessions, be that voting our way in a UN resolution or privatizing their lumber industry and selling it off to their buddies at the banks or whatever, some deal that they didn't want. And it was a light bulb moment for me because I didn't understand the scope of it, that you could do this with, yeah, I understood you could get people into debt and then make them do your bidding, but entire countries? That's diabolical. And World Bank and IMF, I don't even really know much about them. Who are these people? And let me go down that rabbit hole. And so that woke me up to the scam of banking, international banking, and how it is used as a tool to club countries that get on the wrong side of the American empire into submission. And from that book, I'll tell you, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today if it wasn't for that book. And yes, James, you and I will be speaking next week, but I'll also be speaking with John Perkins next week again. Awesome. And over the years, nice. He and I have had several conversations about his role as an economic hitman, what that meant, his role as an author, the second component of his life where he's trying to redeem himself for some of the sins that he had participated in. So to me, look, whatever book gets you to the party, you know, whenever it gets you there, and it's different for everybody, and it's very hard to know what it's going to be for every person, but when it hits you, and it changes your life, you got to go with it. That's your job. And when it puts you on a new path, you need to recognize that your life has been moved for a reason, and you need to open yourself up and maybe allow the universe to take you down a path that you might not have traveled on before.
That's exactly it. And that's exactly why we're here recommending books like this for people out there. But actually, you know, it strikes me that is one of the books that I read in the very, very, very early days of Corbett Report, just as I was sort of starting this work. So I still had one foot sort of in normie world and one foot in this new conspiracy world. And so I'm reading this book and, oh, yeah, okay, I get the sense of it. But what's interesting about it in retrospect is that it was a fairly popular book and has gotten quite a bit of relatively mainstream attention. I'd say there's a lot of people still in normie world who have probably read or at least heard of this book. So I think that's an interesting part of this. It seems to be one of those books that does sort of draw people into, oh, you know, there might be things going on behind the scenes that you haven't heard about.
Yeah. Yeah. He found a way to make money interesting. Banking. Yeah. He found a way to make banking 007, you know, in a way that normally is a snooze fest.
Yeah. Exactly right. No, but it is a genuinely interesting book to read, let alone an informative book. So yeah, good choice. All right, thank you very much for that, Charlie. Let's move right along to Kit Knightley, who is always joining the Independent Media Alliance at some like ungodly hour in the morning in the UK. So I made you wait till last just to make sure that you are as awake as possible. All right. So, Kit Knightley, first tell people how they can find your work at Off Guardian, and then tell us about your book. Unless there is some problem with the connection.
No, that's fine. I just couldn't find the unmute button. And it's not that ungodly. It's only 12:30. Well, my work can be found at Off Guardian, where I'm the editor, and on Substack, where I put the rather less political and more entertaining things that I consider myself to write. The book was a difficult decision. It was actually a peculiarly long decision. I was like looking at all my bookshelves for a very long time, and I decided early on most people will be choosing nonfiction, so I would choose fiction as a point of principle. And then the obvious choice became 1984. But what are the chances that anybody who is viewing this or anybody who reads any of us regularly hasn't already read 1984? Like, read 1984 is the drink more water of book advice. There are more people giving the advice than are left who haven't heard it already. It's not very fun either. Then the artist in me said, choose something that's like a monument to the written word, like Tom Jones or Pride and Prejudice or something like that. But in the end, it was actually an emotional impulse rather than an intellectual decision that made me land on Small Gods by Terry Pratchett, which is, it's a brilliant book. It's a brilliant book that I read at a young age. for those unfamiliar, Terry Pratchett is a British novelist. He wrote a long series of books set in the Discworld, which is like a satirical other Earth, a flat planet that flies through space on the back of a giant turtle. And he uses different books in the series to tackle different subjects. And at their best, they are both thought-provoking and hilarious. And Small Gods is the best. That's subjective, but it's the best. Just believe me. It tackles the very idea of belief and the power of belief, the nature of religion versus belief. The central conceit being that gods do exist, but they are given power by the number of people that believe in them. The smaller number of people believe in them, the smaller the god. The more people believe, the bigger the god. The central plot revolves around the Church of Om, which is the biggest church on the Discworld, and how the god that this focuses on, Om himself, wakes up one morning and finds himself small. Just, he's a small sentient turtle, and that's all he is. And this is despite millions of people claiming to believe in him. So what's the conceit here? What's the problem? What's the contradiction? Why is he like this? And as it turns out, only one person in the whole world actually believes in the god. All the rest, they follow the rules and they listen to the priests and they do the rituals, but none of them really believe. I will quote the book here. Around the god there forms a shell of prayers and ceremonies and buildings and priests and authority, until at last the god dies, and this death may not be noticed. Which is a very powerful idea, separating the church from the god it supposedly serves. I won't spoil the plot entirely. It's a very good book, and you should definitely read it. I read it when I was 13, and it basically blew my mind. And this idea that belief is not a passive internal process, but it has a power to impact the world and even create things. It's an important idea. And I think it's a power that the people that are in charge of the world are aware of and use against us. But it's also a power that we can use against them, and we would have the advantage because there's so many more of us.
You know, you have also recommended a book that I haven't read, but one that I have heard over and over throughout my life. People have recommended it and said Pratchett is a great writer. I have never read Pratchett. So okay, so I'm going to start dipping my toe into Discworld. How many books are in this series?
Well, there's, I believe it was 24. But you don't have to read them all.
Okay.
They subdivide into series, and they're actually at their best when they're one-offs. I would say this is the best. I would say the second best is a book called The Truth, which I have read, I don't know, 50 times. It's about the press and the birth of the press and what the press is and how it works, or how it should work. It's a very good one as well.
So Small Gods could be read on its own. I don't have to read every
Absolutely,
other.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, all right, good. Definitely will check it out. As I say, people have been recommending to me my whole life. And you know what, Kit? You have the exact same experience as me, because I was thinking, what one book am I going to boil this down to? And I racked my brains. I put way too much thought into this. Okay, is it fiction or nonfiction? Well, nonfiction's too obvious. Plus, I have talked about hundreds of books over the years at Corbett Report. So let's do a fiction book. Okay, Absalom's my favorite novel, but most people won't like that. So how about As I Lay Dying? That's an easier Faulkner novel. No, maybe that's not going to be interesting to people. And how did that inspire me? I don't know. Okay, Ulysses by James Joyce. Obviously, it was formative. That's part of the reason I went to Ireland to study. But no, again, it's kind of hoity-toity. How about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? That's fun. People will like reading that, but I don't know. Is it that serious? Okay, I'll Animal Farm. That's it. Anyway, I went through quite a process coming up with my pick here. All right, let's bring everybody back on stage then. Okay, so we have had our recommendations, and oops. Sorry. Okay. Sorry about that. All right, so now we're all back on stage, and let's start talking about this. But first, let's go to the comments of the people who are watching this live, because they have some of their own recommendations. For example, Anastasia recommends The Master and His Emissary, The Divided Brain and the Making of the Western World by Ian McGilchrist. And I know of this book because I have listened to, I think, a couple of interviews, podcasts with Ian McGilchrist about this book. It's, from what I understand, it's about the left-right brain division, but from a very scientific perspective. I mean, he's done serious research on this, not like, you know, pop social psychology kind of stuff, and about how the world is divided. The brain has been divided and the implications of that. I won't go into any further explication of it because, as I say, I haven't read it, but I've heard it is a very interesting book. Has anyone else on the panel read this book? No. All right.
I have not.
Well, anyway, I actually do have it on a to-read list, but my to-read list is about 400 books long, so I'll see when I get to it. All right, we also have this in from Olga. Another very inspiring book for me is Bill Mollison's Permaculture, A Designer's Manual. In November, we organize ICP16 Thailand 2026 International Permaculture Convergence. Are any permies here? This is, again, Bill Mollison's Permaculture Designer Manual. I know I have heard about this book, and is, in fact, I'm sure it was recommended by a previous Solutions Watch guest, or two, maybe. But I haven't read it myself yet. It is, again, it's on my to-read list. Anyone actually read this book in the panel? No. No permies here, unfortunately, Olga. But I am very sympathetic to the permaculture idea and cause. The only misgiving I have is that permies tend to be climate change sort of, you know, believers in that part of the narrative. And that's why, specifically, if you go back in the archives, I had someone interview me. I was a sort of a permaculture designer kind of person who was trying to introduce me and my thought to the permaculture audience. It's like, you know, you don't have to believe in this kind of net zero kind of stuff in order to be a permaculture person. Anyway, I should read Mollison's Permaculture, A Designer's Manual. So thank you for that recommendation. Let's see, what else have we got here? Economic Hitman is amazing. Yes, agreed. All right, cool. So people are enjoying that. And there's some back and forth about, I guess, Solari Report. Catherine Austin Fitz recently recommended that, so people have been reading it. Small Gods and Gulliver's Travels are two more I am interested in reading. Interesting. Yeah, okay. Well, Small Gods is now on my reading to read list. And Gulliver's Travels, of course, by Swift. Right. Famous work of literature that we're all familiar with, if we have read or not. Anything else?
Jack Black movie.
Not the same, sir.
Not the same. Slick Kev, Coming Out of the Ice by Victor Herman. Mad in America, Robert Whittaker. I am unfamiliar with either of those recommendations. Is anyone familiar with those? Sorry.
I've heard of Coming Out of the Ice, but I haven't read it.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have any idea what it's about?
I would imagine cold.
No, I'm thinking Encino Man. I saw the movie.
Right, that. The foreword is by Pauly Shore, so that tracks.
I would do my Pauly Shore imitation, but I actually forget what he's. What does he sound like again?
He's got the weasel. Come on,
you know, please do that. Please do that,
buddy.
It was too much from the 80s. Oh, okay. The Divine Comedy by Dante is the best epic poem ever written. Thank you, Christopher Columbus, for that recommendation. Yeah, you can't go wrong with Divine Comedy. I only read The Inferno, and that was decades ago. And it probably went over my head at the time. I was probably too young to be properly appreciating it. But also, it depends on translation, right? I mean, especially when you're talking about poetry, a good translation or a bad translation can make it or break it, right? So
nice to get a recommendation from Christopher Columbus, though.
Right. Yeah, I know. I'm glad to draw you for that. Thank you, Christopher Columbus.
You should definitely know.
Elk Clear Sight. I actually like David Icke's books. First one I read, The Biggest Secret. It's easy to read, and I think he is actually a good writer. You know what? I will confess, I have never read a David Icke book.
I've read The Biggest Secret, and I remember reading it and thinking to myself, well, if lizard people are real, this better be The Biggest Secret. So, you know, That's an old school classic. I've got his roadmap with me. I've read sections of that. So for me, I've always liked the Ike lectures a little bit more. I think he has a good screen presence, and there's a lot of visual aids with that. But look, I don't believe in lizard people. But at the same time, you know, we talked a little bit with my book on, you know, SRA, satanic ritual abuse, child abuse at high levels. And that is in that book. So listen, he may not get everything right, but he was one of the first people to really highlight the British royal family in that regard, too. So kudos to Ike.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Fair enough. And one more. Simply Darkness says, my book choice is Propaganda, The Formation of Men's Attitudes by Jacques Ellul. More than any other book, it helped me understand how the average normie is desperately dependent on the elite's propaganda to explain to them why they're supposed to endure the soul-crushing hellscape of modernity, completely disconnected from nature, tradition, and human connection. Excellent recommendation, Simply Darkness. And I say that as someone who has not read this book yet, but it is absolutely on near the top of my to read list and has been for years. I'm going to so disappoint Andrew Hoffman if Andrew is listening to this. Sorry, but I have not yet read Ellul, but I really want to because I've heard a lot about this. And I have also heard that, you know, it's all cool and trendy and internet edgelordy to be like, Uncle Ted, ooh, let's read, you know, Ted Kaczynski. He was right, you know, that kind of thing. Ooh, I'm so edgy. Whereas, actually, I mean, Jacques Ellul was writing about that before, and he didn't need to kill anyone to make his point. So maybe, and he wasn't an MK Ultra weirdo, so maybe people should be reading Ellul instead of Uncle Ted. Woohoo, I'm so cool. Anyway, so yes, that's absolutely on my to-read list.
It's been recommended to me more than once. I just wrote it down. No, I haven't read it either, but it's something that somebody's recommended to me, and I wrote it down just so I didn't forget.
Yeah. All right. Burmese, you raised the specter of the Animal Farm animation that has just recently come out. Andy Serkis, right? Golem from The Lord of the Rings is somehow involved in this, right?
I'm not sure if he directed it. I haven't watched it yet. I heard somebody else talking about it the other day. I'll say this, out of everything we talked about, the only two other books that I've actually read are Gulliver's Travels and Animal Farm. Animal Farm, we didn't read 1984. And, you know, we read Animal Farm, and that was kind of my introduction to Orwell. And I'll be honest, I think I read it at probably 12 or 13 years old. It was either like an eighth or ninth grade, and I didn't grasp it enough. You know, it still kind of stood in my head, kind of this, you know, metamorphosis aspect that they come up and what is it? Some animals are more animal than others,
some are more equal than others.
Yeah, some are more equal than others. And that always stuck with me as well. But it wasn't until kind of my deluge into this world where almost everything seemed like propaganda post 9/11 that I got to Orwell's other works. And what I did end up doing, I think, is watching, I think it was the 80s. Film 1984. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's okay, but it's no Brazil. Like Brazil, for me, with the dark humor with it, it kind of had more of an impact where it's kind of on that same kind of level. But, you know, for me, I was reading some books, but I was just such a movie head. Like, you know, everybody was talking about, you know, these books that they read when they were younger. You know, I was reading like Fight Club and Trainspotting because I love those movies, right? And those books actually ended up being really impactful. In fact, there's a recommendation for people that have just seen Fight Club, the movie. Very short book. David Fincher did genius work with that because he took directly large sections of it. But at the same time, it's very much worth the read because I think it explores the mental illness aspect, especially at the end, a lot more than kind of the tight wrap-up that Fincher gives it.
Right. I remember Irvine Welch's stuff like way too young.
The only two movies that I prefer to the books. I think I might also. I mean, I think they're as good, if not better. I think that you might be right. And look, for those that don't know about Trainspotting, I mean, it's in the dialect of kind of Scottish, and they have like a whole bibliography in the back so you can learn the slang on it. So, you know.
Okay, so with Animal Farm specifically, not only is there the 2026 abomination that I have heard nothing good about, I saw the trailer. It looks absolutely wretch-inducingly bad. I will never watch that crap. But there was, of course, the famous 1954 animation, which was done by a couple of animators from England. And I don't I don't know the full story, but they are apparently like relatively small time animators who had done some like propaganda things at the behest of the government before, but had never done like a major thing. And then some American bagmen show up at their door and like, hey man, we're going to pay you all this money to do Animal Farm. And so, you know, like go at it. And they're like, okay, great. Full feature length Animal Farm. Let's do it. So they start working on it and it goes over budget. It's taking longer than expected, but the money keeps coming. And they think, you know, why? What's going on here? Who is really funding this? And of course, as it turns out, as we now know, of course, it was payrolled by the CIA as part of the CIA Cold War propaganda campaign. And of course, Animal Farm being anti-Soviet, anti-communist, it's perfect Cold War propaganda, right? But, you know, they had to change the ending a little bit because it wasn't enough for it just to be like the men and the pigs are the same, because ultimately what is the message of that? It's saying essentially that, you know, the capitalists are just as bad as the socialists are just as bad as the capitalists. They all turn into the same thing. It's all just hierarchy, which is kind of an anarchistic message if you think about it. So they of course come up with a new ending, which is, oh, okay, so now all the animals get together and overthrow this, the pigs, right? So that's going to be the new ending. And
I thought we were done.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
I always found personally Animal Farm, just in my personal, you know, I just found it more impactful in a lot of ways. You know, like, in like, and I would say actually for average people as well, like 1984 can come across as more alarming, but many people tend to kind of shuck it off as something that's way too unlikely or like, I just feel like that as a young person, like, I think I actually saw I don't know if I read it in school first or if I saw the one you're talking about, James, that black and white. I feel like I might have seen a version like that when I was younger, but either way,
it is color. But you might have seen it in black and white.
Yeah,
it looks like Robin Hood, the animated movie.
Okay, well,
remember that?
That's right, that's right. But either way, my point was that I felt like it relays a very clear message about the way that the people projecting a positive message or promising the world can become just the, you know, it's easier to digest for people, I think. And I always found that to just be, you know, like if you were going to give that one of those two books to somebody just introducing themselves to these kind of ideas, I feel like Animal Farm would probably have more of a real-time, immediate impact. But who knows, maybe with the world where it's about to go or already is, maybe I'm wrong on that now. But that's a thought that I had back then when I was reading, you know, interesting. Yeah, right? We're in technocracy now, so.
All right. Another recommendation from the crowd. Klaus Schwab has shown up in our chat to recommend. I recently read The Acts of King Arthur and His Noble Knights, John Steinbeck's retelling of the Arthurian legend, and found this quote interesting. After a long and turbulent time, King Arthur, through fortune and force of arms, destroyed or made peace with his enemies inside his realm and out, and established in men's minds his right to rule. Then Arthur learned, as all leaders are astonished to learn, that peace, not war, is the destroyer of men. Tranquility, rather than danger, is the mother of cowardice, and not need but plenty brings apprehension and unease. Finally, he found that the longed-for peace so bitterly achieved created more bitterness than ever did the anguish of achieving it, which is probably a very true insight, isn't it? So the upper class view wars as necessary, Yes, I think you might be right about that. Yes, it is. And of course, my mind immediately goes to Norman Dodd of the Rees Commission. And I'm sure people on this panel have seen that famous interview. I believe, was it G. Edward Griffin's interview with him, where he expounds on his work with the Rees Commission, going through the archives and records of the Carnegie Endowment from its inception in 1908 and its early meetings of the directors. And they discussed in a very learned manner if there is any force that is as effective as war in bringing about drastic change in society. And they debate this in a very learned manner over the course of a year. And he's talking about going through the records of these debates. And he says, you know, at the end of the year, they decide, in fact, no, there is nothing better than war for changing society. And thus, they then turn their attention to the question of how do we get the U.S. embroiled in a war? And bada bing, bada boom, a few years later, World War One, and eventually Wilson, who kept us out of war, brought them into war. So there you go. So anyway, I'd say leaders learn very early on that warfare is extremely beneficial for the purposes of keeping people in check. So yes, The Acts of King Arthur and His Noble Knights, John Steinbeck. I have not read that, but I might give it a read at your suggestion. Thank you, Mr. Schwab. All right. Anyone got any secondary recommendations or things they really, you know, books they wanted to bring up in
I had one, and then I probably have to jump off somewhat early, but that's why I was laughing when you said that, James, because I figured you were going to, you know, I thought like, you know, everyone's going to have a secondary, and you're like, just one. Like, damn it. And this is somewhat, I don't know if it's mainstream or not, but it's a book that I came across, let's say, I would maybe say a couple years before I ended up like, I don't know. I think it was maybe high school or a little bit earlier, but The Way of the Peaceful Warrior by, what was the name again? Dan Millman. And it's been made a movie out of it and stuff. And it's just, you know, honestly, I've never even reflected back on the book itself about whether or not there was, I haven't read it again. I read it twice, but it was a long time ago. So I bet you if I reread it now, I'd probably pick things out that might connect, you know what I mean? Like who knows if there's, you know, deeper ideas within it that I didn't, but to me, it was such a profound kind of a, you know, it's spiritual, but it's also sort of about like trials and how you're coming, you know, basically the long story short of it, the guy meets this person as his life's kind of falling apart as like a gymnast and ultimately ends up like a spiritual journey with this guy who's sort of a, I don't want to say too much because, you know, sort of a spoiler in the way, but there's more of like a spiritual journey. This guy is sort of like a guide for him and opens his mind to like just profound things beyond, you know, it's just fascinating. And he has this whole trial and, you know, as he, you know, gains back things in his life. But it was just such an interesting, like, it was one of the books that really opened my mind to deeper thoughts beyond just like the here and now and the material, you know, like a deeper way to look at the world, which really did open me to many other thoughts beyond that. And I just thought it's worth throwing out there for people that, you know, this is something, like I think I said it, they made a movie about it, which was pretty terrible, I think. It didn't really encapsulate the feeling of it. It was more, you know, just the anyway. But I think the book would be, I think, powerful for some people that want to start thinking about things like that, you know, looking beyond right in front of you.
Yeah, nice. Has anyone else read that? I have not. Anyone else here? No, okay. Good. Good. Interesting recommendation. I'm going to check it out. And yeah, like 99% of the time, the book is better than the movie. It's almost the rule of thumb, except for Trainspotting and Fight Club, I'd say. All right. Ryan, thank you for that. And I'll let you dip out here. So, Kit, you were wrestling and thinking about what book to recommend. You must have a secondary recommendation for people, something that you considered.
My secondary recommendation would have been Animal Farm, actually. No.
In fact, I was thinking 1984, but that's way too obvious. So, you know, Animal Farm, sure.
Well, I mentioned a few of them before. I suppose to go to the nonfiction route, I'd recommend a book called Who Murdered Chaucer? By Terry Jones. Terry Jones, the ex-Monty Python. For anybody who don't know, he was into history as well. And he did some really good
stuff. He was a scholar, yeah.
As a lot of what sets him apart for most people who talk about history is he talks about history as if it really happened, but didn't necessarily have to happen. You know, he doesn't talk about something about the inevitability of things we know happened. Mm. He talks about people as if they were people, and he considers that a lot of what written down history is what people want you to think happened rather than what actually happened. And it's a very interesting, very open-minded take. And for anybody who doesn't know, the English poet Chaucer, nobody knows what happened to him. He was writing, and he was writing for the current regime, Richard II, and then Henry IV overthrew Richard II, and Chaucer basically disappeared. So it's about investigating what happened to him. And you know,
is that like really, truly true? I had no idea.
Yeah. I've got the book around here somewhere. I mean, obviously, I don't need to prove the book exists. I didn't just make it up off the top of my head. But yeah, it's true. Yes.
Shows my ignorance of Chaucer, I guess, because I did not know that particular part of his biography. Interesting.
Without a patron, where could he go? Mm.
Such are the vicissitudes of writing under a patronage system. All right, Kit Knightley, thank you again for your participation, as always, at the slightly ungodly hour of coming on 1 a.m. or whatever it is. All right. Thank you for that, and I'll let you dip out of the conversation. Charlie, any secondary recommendation for us?
There's a book that is more about like a personal development, putting yourself in a place of gratitude, that sort of mindset, more, I don't know, kind of more woo-woo, I suppose, but in a very positive way. A Happy Pocket Full of Money by a guy named David Cameron Gilcandy. And I read that book 15 years ago, and it was so, again, sometimes it's the book and sometimes it's the timing of the book. You know, had I read that book maybe at a different time in my life, it wouldn't have had the impact on me, but I was at kind of a crossroads and looking for something and found this book, and this book is a bit of a reminder to be appreciative for what you have and to not always be out into the future and trying to live in the future and not in the present and all these really positive reminders. And it hit me at the right time, I think, when I needed it. And the message was relatively simple, wasn't overcomplicated. It wasn't all done up to feel more fancy than it was. And there was something about it that I read it twice. And now, you know, if you read a book twice, you're, oh, geez. So at that moment, that's what I needed then. And it kind of pushed me off, not a brand new orbit, but, you know, just enough to get your head right where you say, oh yeah, I got to snap out of this negative mindset. And this is a reminder to course correct a little bit. So sometimes you need that push, and that book was that for me at that time.
Nice. I haven't even heard of it. So another fresh, completely new recommendation. And Charlie, we're going to be talking very soon, in the next week or so. Tell people again about your podcast and how people can find it.
Macroaggressions is the podcast. We've been doing it now for about 6 years. And I hope people will take a look. Macroaggressions.io is the website where you can find us. Activist Post is the news website. Please make sure to bookmark Activist Post. We didn't build an app because we saw what happened with Zero Hedge. There's no sense doing that and getting it all stepped on by Apple and Google. So just fire it up as a browser on your phone. If you're somebody who gets your information on your phone, bookmark it and make sure to sign up for our email newsletter, because as James says, it's the best way for us to stay in touch. You know, if they cut the cord.
Yeah. Email newsletters and RSS are the way to go.
That's
awesome. Charlie, thank you for that. I'll be talking to you again next week. All right. Steve.
Yeah.
You're a Discworld fan?
I love it. I do. I got introduced to Discworld when I was on the road during Renaissance festivals in the early 2000s. And when you live in a campground and you don't have electricity, you tend to do a lot of reading. And so it helped me while away many an hour. And yeah, man, I have been enthralled and enamored with that world ever since. It's my favorite cosmology, as a matter of fact.
I hear this all my life. All my life, people have been saying this to me, but somehow I've managed to avoid it. So I guess I got to dip in. Do you agree with Kit that I should start with Small Gods or what?
I think Small Gods is a good place to start. If you wanted to be a traditionalist about it, you should start with The Color of Magic, which I think is the very first Discworld book. But it's really one of those things where you can pick any one of the 20 plus up, read it independently of itself. And then as you read more, you start to realize that it's an all-incorporating world. But if I was going to recommend a different book, I guess my fiction would be The Story of Bee by Daniel Quinn, which is hands down one of my favorite pieces of writing on the entire planet. And just a general overall plot synopsis is a young Jesuit priest gets brought into the higher ups and informed that the Jesuit order is effectively the Vatican intelligence agency and spy network. And he's been selected to go spy and report on a public speaker who calls himself B, whom the Catholic Church has decided may be a possible candidate for the Antichrist. Mm-hmm. Based solely off what he's speaking, and what he's speaking is, it wasn't always this way, and it doesn't always have to be this way. And there are, you know, different methods of thinking that produce societal impact that, in the opinion of the speaker, is greater than that of what the church produced, and therefore is the origin point of the conflict. And it goes on and goes through all of B's lectures and the formative changes that go throughout the mind of the Jesuit priest as a result of this and the inherent struggles that he has. And if I was going to do a nonfiction book, it would be Smoke and Mirrors, The War on Drugs and the Politics of Failure by a guy named Dan Baum. It was published early 90s, I believe, and it's just a very, at times, stale dissection of the United States of America's drug policy, its origins, and its effects. And you can take this particular example and apply it across the board to every war on that the United States is engaged in, up to and through, you know, the war on terror, but certainly the current one on domestic violent extremists who are these ridiculous anti-technology people who for some reason don't want massively resource destroying data centers and an all-encompassing spy network forced on them at all times.
Yeah. Yeah, good recommendation. Well, again, I haven't heard of either of those books. The Story of B, when was that published?
I believe it was late 70s or early 80s. Have you ever heard of Ishmael or call My Name is Ishmael or something like that? It's about a talking gorilla. The same author, Daniel Quinn, wrote the Ishmael books and Story of B. I really did. Every time I bring it up, people look at me like I have four heads. I don't even know how I found the book. For a couple of years, I was convinced that I just made it up entirely. And it was something that I hallucinated. But then I've corroborated that it does exist. And so, I can't. It is enthralling. And it's one of those things.
You're not the only one. Elizabeth.
Oh, hey, cool. Yes,
I read My Name is Ishmael. So there you go.
Excellent. There you go. Yeah. Yeah, no, a fantastic author, fantastic storyteller.
And Smoke and Mirrors is on archive.org. So for the benefit of everyone watching along, I will be, when I post the show notes, I will try to put the archive.org link to all these books so that you can have a copy. And
I can't recommend Story of B.
Whoever's left watching this by the end of this conversation, if you require print disability access because you wear glasses or because your finger hurts or whatever it is, you can apply for that. And because, you know, archive.org, they used to be able to borrow anything with a free account, right? But then they had the whole lawsuit thing. But now it's only available for people with print disability access. So if you tell them that you have print disability access.
My finger is killing me.
Exactly. So anyway, that's the hint for people out there who need that. Archive.org, basically any book in the world you can read for free. So,
that's great.
Please do so. Awesome. Steve, thank you again for your recommendations. I hope people are keeping up with AM Wake Up, and we should hook up again sometime.
Yes, sir. I'll contact you over the next couple of days.
Awesome. All right. Take care. Jason?
Yeah, I was sitting here racking my brain, right?
Whoa. Yeah.
What could we talk about? And, you know, especially during my awakening into 9/11, I read a ton of books, right? I was thinking to myself, a lot of people aren't aware of Sander Hicks's The Big Wedding, and that has a lot of the Pakistani stuff. And I think that's a good short read. Academically, obviously, David Ray Griffin put out a series of books that I think are relevant to this day. But my recommendation is actually going to be Synthetic Terror by Webster Tarpley. And, you know, Webster has gone a little deep on his politics, let's just say. He's always been kind of a leftist and like a very much a socialist kind of guy, loved FDR. I got to spend a lot of time with Webster. And yeah, there were times when Webster early on wasn't my biggest fan, but we ended up building quite the rapport. And I'll just say about that book and why I'm choosing it is just like with the Franklin scandal, it comes at it from a very academic viewpoint, right? It still is able to tell a narrative, but then it is highly sourced. And I specifically remember at the time reading that one, it was probably the best source for the war games that had happened on 9/11. Now that section itself was extensive. So, you know, he's done a lot of work out there, and I would encourage people to check out a lot of his stuff, right? You know, go Webster.
Here's the question for you. Yeah. Mr. 9/11. What do you think of Crossing the Rubicon? Rupert, Michael Rupert.
So, yeah, there was another one that I read that could have come up. And Rupert, I was introduced, just like I was kind of talking to you about Ike and his lectures. It was actually a lecture that Michael Rupert was giving post 9/11 on not only the stock options and put options, but how basically the major banks and airlines were fronts for the Central Intelligence Agency. And he did a really good job of describing that. And that's also
he had some of the best and best documented work right after the, you know, the couple of years after. Because when did Crossing the Rubicon come out? It was like 2003 or something.
Yeah, I think that's really early. I think it's just like most of these books that were kind of, and I don't think that Tarpley was, I think that was 2003, 2004. I'd even read Huff Schmidt's. He put out what, Painful Questions and Painful Deceptions with the documentary film. So I'd read a lot of these things.
Yeah.
And I was hungry for all this stuff. And look, you know, that's like a phone book. And I think that it's kind of held up to this day. As far as Rupert as a person, I think that especially, James, you've been around a lot. There's a lot of complexities with a lot of these personalities, unfortunately.
I think he went off the deep end. But
well, I mean, he did kill himself. And I don't think that anybody's even questioning that. Like, it was pretty apparent. He went on air kind of alluding to it beforehand. And, you know, when you're behind the scenes, you kind of talk to other people. I'd met Rupert once. And then the other thing is he got that Leonardo DiCaprio documentary film out there. I'm trying to think what it's called. It starts with a C, Collapse. He did that Collapse documentary. And I remember at the time I had watched it and I thought it was a lot of fear mongering because one of the things that kind of came with Crossing the Rubicon was the idea of peak oil. Which, I mean, here we are in 2026, and I think that that's been pretty disproven, right? And a lot of the motivation, he said, for this false flag was this idea of peak oil. And so he does Collapse where, you know, again, I'm not trying to go after people as fear porn or whatever, right? But that's another thing that you kind of have to pull yourself back into is reality and what's going on. And that was a big documentary film. And I remember at the time I wanted to go on air and I wanted to do a critique of it. And I had already done a critique of Zeitgeist 2 with Jones because I was at InfoWars at the time. And I'll never forget it. Jones was like, what are you trying to do, Permis? I'll sue us all. You know, so, you know, I kind of refrained at the time. And I'm certainly not trying to speak ill of the dead because I think that Crossing the Rubicon also did a lot of good work, especially on the drills, especially on the banking, especially on the Central Intelligence Agency. And Rupert was one of those guys that was also very open about talking about the drug connections of our Central Intelligence Agency and these other organizations that kind of act as fronts, right? And look, all of that's relevant to this day. I am so deep into these Epstein files right now. You know, again, I had Nick Bryan on, right? And one of the things we often talk about is Epstein's connection to Iran-Contra. Well, Bryan actually has two pieces on his Substack on different arms deals that Epstein was a part of, I think all the way up into the run of like 2016, 17 with like the Crown Prince of Norway. So you start pulling on a thread, man. So many of these things are connected and Webster Tarpley will help you connect them with synthetic terror.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, you know, there was some good stuff in there, but yes, Olga writes, peak everything is another myth I would like to bring up at IPC 16, the permaculture conference. I can use help. I do have something in the archives. I did put something together that was quoting from Fletcher Prouty, who tackled that issue. So look up my Prouty stuff. Just type Prouty into my search engine and you'll find something from that. But yeah, I should probably revisit that because it is, I don't know. Is it still like a big myth that people are pushing these days? I don't know. But anyway, it still exists as an idea.
Peak oil?
Yeah.
Peak oil has been abandoned by the professional, what would you call it? The professional pool of PR people that work for, you know, that live off of the oil companies.
Yeah.
It's not a thing anymore. They don't need it. You know, they're not exactly pushing.
Well, they've already got the $100 plus barrel of oil, so they don't need to.
Well, you know, whatever the price, whatever happens to the price of oil, oil companies are actors on the world stage. Chevron right now is, you know, mad about, I forgot his name, but he's the president of the United States. His back and forth with Iran because they're a client. You know, Chevron is in partnership with. I mean, they make their money. It's an interesting point you make, though, Jason. Also about the CIA, commercial aviation is a front for the CIA, right? I mean, stand back America. A little bit.
You wonder why they could keep losing billions of dollars and it's only Spirit Airlines that goes out, right? Like, and sure. By the way, you just mentioned Chevron. Just to kind of pull that 9/11 thread, let's not forget that right after we took over Afghanistan, who got installed? Well, an ex-Chevron executive.
Yeah, oh, of course.
Hamid Karzai. And by the way, we talked a little bit about drugs. How about his brother Waleed being the number one opium warlord in that region?
Yeah, where did Condi Rice cut her teeth, you know?
Where did Condi Rice cut her teeth? Don't leave
Chevron. Chevron.
Ah, I didn't.
Yeah, sorry. Cool. I mean, it starts to sound, I mean, I'm very impressed by your work, Jason, because you've got it all, you know, going on all at the same time. And it doesn't sound like jaded and over it. You've got enthusiasm and your, you know, Webster Tarpley suggestion is really good. And we were talking about Peter Dale Scott before we came on camera, you know, it's all there. And the war on drugs, you know, it's all there.
The road to 9/11. All right, Bermie, thank you as always for your contribution. I hope people are checking out your work and we'll be talking to you next panel, I hope. All right. And then there were two. That is Tim and James.
Here we are again.
And Tim, I would say my secondary recommendation, because again, I put a lot of thought into this. If I had a secondary recommendation, it would actually be Dune by Frank Herbert.
Dune?
Because again, keeping to the parameters of what we're talking about, books that have inspired, I want to think about something that I read when I was relatively young. So I was a teenager when I read Dune. And it was mind-blowing to me. It was incredibly elaborate, well thought out, and philosophically interesting work that, again, was an incredibly interesting insight into power and how power operates and corrupts, etc. Because, power, of course, people who don't know, Herbert inverts the chosen one hero myth mythology. And the one that you think is going to be the chosen one to come along to save the day, it actually turns out to be kind of evil. Oh, wait, what's going on? Or it becomes somewhat evil. So you
what you're talking about is sort of the narrative structure, the way he populates his narrative. But that book itself had such an impact on the culture. Speaking of intellectual history, Dune is like, you know, to not just science fiction, but ecology and, you know, applied natural sciences, as like the Beatles were, you know, to pop music and to pop culture.
Get that bitten apple off your screen, by the way. Get that satanic bitten apple off your screen. There we go.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. And the funny thing is, for people who don't know about the publication history of that, he shopped it out to every publisher, got a rejection from every single publisher, and it ended up getting published by some like automotive parts supply catalog publisher or something.
Weird thing like that. You know, it's funny that I made a note of it earlier that Charlie mentioned Confessions of an Economic Hitman. That was first published by a publisher in San Francisco called Barrett Kohler. And, you know, went to number one with a bullet at the time. It's on Penguin now, or one of their imprints now. But they were publishing, that company didn't publish anything like that before or after. They were doing they still exist. They do kind of feel good, socially and environmentally responsible self-fulfillment. It's not, I don't mean to put it down. It's just a genre that they do and what they don't do, you know. The second book that Charlie recommended is right up their alley, but I looked it up and they didn't publish that. But so I think he had to shop that thing around too, meaning Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which is that's an incredible book. And it holds up so much better. I was actually reading through it not that long ago, maybe a year or two ago. It holds up much better than, what was the other one? Shock Doctrine. Which was also at the same time, you know, it was a similar kind of book, Naomi Klein. And where did she end up? I mean,
exactly. She's a WEF promoting,
she was actually a very good writer. I mean, she's one of the few people who could make it, who could make a transition from magazine articles to a full, you know, T-bone steak thick book. And it was very readable. Gave that book to a couple of siblings of mine, just to, like, you know, here's how it works, you know. Yeah. With the big bullet hole on the cover.
It's interesting. I haven't gone back to reread Confessions of an Economic Hitman, but I should.
Oh, it's, I'd like to and see. It's, you know, it's like, you know, we talk about these things. We talk about the CIA and all of their chicanery and the Cold War. Well, there's a new paradigm, you know, and that basically, it's actually, I remember this now from one of the DVD extras from the Criterion edition of The Spy Who Came In from the Cold. The DVD extras on that are pretty interesting because it's the author, John le Carré, John Cornwell, commenting, and there's an interview there with him, I think, from Democracy Now. And he points out that, you know, well, since the Cold War ended, his books are basically just about money laundering because it's, that's what it is. You know, you walk into a bank with $1 million in cash, you'll go to jail, right? You walk in with $100 million, you'll have lunch with the bank manager.
Yeah.
And he said that. I mean, and it's exactly the kind of chaos that he didn't make such a moral comment about it, but I mean, he calls it chaos. It's like, well, let's not talk about what MI5 and MI6 and CIA, all the rest of them have been sowing, you know, since he was.
But how would John le Carré know anything about spy?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all in the open. Yeah.
Anyway, so do you have a secondary recommendation?
I do. I don't have a copy of it here. Actually, this is one that had a huge effect on me, but I don't necessarily recommend it.
Okay.
My father was an administrator in the Federal Highway Department. That's from 1970. Anyway. I've mentioned this to you before, and it keeps coming up because it keeps coming up in these podcast circles, especially what Steve and Ryan were both talking about, as well as Jason, when they brought up David Icke. And there's an author, she's passed, long passed, named Frances Yates, Y-A-T-E-S, not spelled like William Butler Yeats, but like the English way. And Frances with an E. She's a scholar, and she wrote, and again, it's intellectual history. She wrote a number of books, but the one that I'm thinking of is called The Rosicrucian Enlightenment. And I'm sure it's available in PDF form. In fact, I know it is, should be. She also wrote another book called The Art of Memory. She wrote a book about Giordano Bruno. She's writing about occultism and in the context of Western European intellectual history in the Renaissance period when secret societies, the Freemasonry, esotericism, all these things basically entered mainstream, you know, sort of elite intellectual culture. I mean, you had, you know, everybody, the Doge of Venice, the Pope in Rome, you know, they were all not necessarily Rosicrucians per se. She doesn't use that that word to mean Rosicrucianism per se. The Rosicrucian Enlightenment she's referring to as an aspect of the Enlightenment, capital E, or maybe another facet of it, which you know, grew out of the Renaissance and gave us, you know, humanism and rationalism and the whole, you know, Western tradition. But it's really fascinating, and I recommend it maybe as much to your guests, your roundtable guests here, as well as to general audiences. Although it is kind of scholarly and it's a little bit dense, but she's talking about the reality of it. And you understand, you can gain an understanding of the actual intent and origin of secret societies and occult mystical practice without the mystification that's built into just talking about it. You know, it treats it as a real thing. And once you know the intent, you know, by their works shall ye know them. Or possibly, I looked this up this morning, it's from a P.G. Wodehouse story, where Jeeves says something like, he's talking about socialism, but he said, it is as well to know exactly the tune that the devil is playing. Mm. I think that is would only help people who are interested in presenting the fact of, say, secret societies in our lives without getting too worked up over it and without, you know, I mean, it gives you a vocabulary and a handle on it. So that's Francis Yates, the Rosicrucian Enlightenment. But The Art of Memory is also really fascinating, too. It's a much shorter book, The Art of Memory. And that's what it's about. It's about the art of memory.
The art of memory.
Yeah.
All right. Well, before I let you go, I should, I don't have to, but I'm going to let the audience in on a little secret. Is the next edition of Film Literature New World Order, after I talk about Foucault's Pendulum, with a special guest to be announced, which will be happening, by the way, for people who are still interested, on Sunday, August 2nd, 2026 at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. So if you're in New York, Toronto, or somewhere along that line, it will be 8 p.m. your time. Look up your local time for your details. If you want to join that live stream of that conversation, then you can, of course, as a Corporate Report member, log into the website this weekend. I'll be posting up the August open thread, and the link to that conversation will be in the August open thread. So I hope people will join that, because Foucault's Pendulum, such an interesting book. But how about this book, which will be next month's Film Literature in the New World Order? It is Philip K. Dick. It is The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch. And Tim, you and I will be talking about this book because you have recommended it to me. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. In the meantime, Shukuto, we're working on some interesting projects, an interesting series, things we're not ready yet to announce, but that will be coming in the fullness of time, and which people, I hope, will be interested in.
Yes, we've got published books in the pipeline. I mean, we've got a plan.
We have a plan, we have a pipeline, and we have something else that alliterates with P. I don't know. my literary imagination is failing me after all this time, but that's because it is hot and it's getting late, so I think we'll leave it there. Tim, thank you again
thank
for
you.
Your time. And of course, people can go to reportagebook.com if you haven't checked out Reportage yet. If not, why not? Please do. All right, Tim, thank you. All right, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your time and attention. If you made it to the end, congratulations. You now have many, many, many book recommendations. And as I say, they will all be in the show notes when I post this up to the website. So check that out. And I will try to include free versions of books as if they are available. One more before we go. Tyler says, A Biblical Case for Anarchy is another great novel by Jacob Winograd. Winograd? That name sounds familiar, but maybe I'm thinking of some other Winograd. But I have definitely not read A Biblical Case for Anarchy, but it does sound it's up my alley. So thank you for the recommendation. I will check it out. And it is a free book as well, available at libertarianchristians.com. So cool. All right. Thank you to all the people who did participate in this live stream. Once again, if you want to participate in live streams like this in the future and get your recommendations and ideas out there, then, of course, Corporate Report members can log in and get the details on the website. Let me know if you need help with that. But I think we're going to leave that here for today. What an incredible amount of things we have looked at today. So thank you for being along for this ride, and for the other inveterate readers out there in the audience like myself, I hope that this at least satiates your need, your greed, your enthusiastic appetite for books, at least for a month or two. Hopefully these recommendations will keep you occupied, but we're going to leave that there for now. I'm looking forward to talking to you again next week for that Film Literature New World Order on Foucault's Pendulum. Hope to see you there. James Corbett, CorbettReport.com.